C2SP. Number 11A.
Well, when we started with the new subject on truth, perhaps you noticed that I was a bit irritated for a moment. It was because I was reading the false epitome, namely truth in the third part instead of in the second part. And just for the moment, I had to go on talking and thinking something is not quite right. So at that moment, you notice perhaps that I didn't give you the subtones, but because I thought this is not true. because I was reading on page 8, truth, you see, and when I was doing that, I thought, this is funny. How is that? So let's rectify that. Just the epitome was wrong. All the rest is okay. Truth, really, here in the subject, again, shows the two opposite of Christian Science and spiritualism. The epitome there reads, in Christian Science, mental images can always be called back to consciousness, whereas spiritualism can never become conscious of true reality. This is the point. You know, we have then gone on through the subtones, which we did all right, because I didn't go back to the epitomes, because I knew something is fishy there. And only afterwards I saw that I had opened the wrong page. So we have come to the point of principle, namely, first of all, as mind, that we can see, because more mental concept can always be taken from pictorial thought. That's why it's possible to bring back to consciousness what has gone before or what has happened in another place, way away. And that as spirit we saw, because they are always first formed mentally before they become material conception, like with the artist, he forms first the picture, the thought of what he wants to paint, and then he puts it on canvas, and then he objectifies it. And so, as soul, we saw, because the mind reader can always reproduce these atmospheres of thought, no matter if that person is present or is not present, no matter if that person still lives or doesn't live anymore, they just can pick up the atmosphere, the mental atmosphere, and can discern and describe and transmit it. Naturally, we have to remember that these mind readers, small M mind readers, they can only really reproduce what is in the mental realm of the human mind. They can never read reality. So they can, if they read, say, if they would read my past, they can only read a mental picture of my past, but not my true identity. They will not be able to do that. That's what is developing spiritually within me. This cannot be seen through mind, mortal mind reading. This is something that belongs to the divine mind realm of consciousness. We go on to life and see on the life that this can be reproduced because they present primal facts to mortal mind. These primal facts are always there. They float in the general atmosphere of the human mind, not in the general atmosphere of the divine mind. The text here says the Scotch call such vision second sight, when really it is first sight instead of second, because they read first sight, they read original mortal thought. For it presents primal facts to mortal mind. Science enables one to read the human mind, but not as a clairvoyant. So we should not try really to read the human mind, But it enables one to heal through mind, capital M, but not as a mesmerist. So we are not in competition with mind readers, small m readers, mind readers. We don't try to simulate them or try to do the same as what they did. We are on a spiritual level and we are very happy not to read all those mortal mind pictures that float in the general atmosphere of mortal mind of everybody and way back through thousands of years. We are only happy if we look out from the divine mind and see what the divine mind is and what it does. Another short indication as a subtone of truth says, well, all this can be called back because the true concept can never be lost. This is a passage here that says, the mind knows naught of the emeralds within its rocks. The sea itself is ignorant of the gems within its caverns, of the corals, of its sharp reefs, of the tall ships that float on its bosom, or of the bodies which lie buried in its sands. Yet these are all there. Do not suppose that any mental concept is gone just because you do not think of it. So this is the point, namely the true concept is never lost. So just because we don't think of it and because we don't investigate it, and that doesn't mean because we are ignorant of it that they are not there. So this is an answer that is being brought up during the break. Well, the true concept is never lost, even then, when we have never thought of it. Impressions produced on mortal mind by friendship or by any intense feeling are lasting. And mind readers can perceive and reproduce these impressions. So it's indicating what we said the last hour. Naturally, all those things that make a great impression on our mind, that they stick much clearer in our mind and can be reproduced much better and much quicker, whereas other things that have not made a deep impression on us, we never think of them again, we never reproduce them again, though they are there. Not only are those feelings present that were very deep feelings, but also everything else is there because they are primal facts. And so mind readers, they can reproduce it because they are more sensitive to it, because they have been trained in it and or have a natural leaning towards it, whereas usually people don't have that ability anymore. And I think it's a good thing. Then finally, in love, we see, because memory can reproduce everything that can be discerned by the senses. So here it's everything is a final point, a total form. Love is always all or nothing. It's always the totality of things. So memory may reproduce voices long ago silent. They can do that. Mind readers can reproduce, say, even voices in foreign languages, in unknown languages that they do not know consciously. They can reproduce that. We have but to close the eyes and forms rise before us which are thousands of miles away or altogether gone from physical sight and sense. So if something has gone from physical sight and sense, like having lost the parents and they are no more here, we still can reproduce and see them. We still can at once have the picture of our mother or our father, though they are no more here. So the thought, the form thought, everything are as primal facts still here and can be reproduced. So time and place does not play any, is no factor. And this is not in dreamy sleep. Sorry, that's the end of the sentence. in dreamy sleep. So it's not only in sleep that we can see, say, the picture very clear of somebody that has passed on. We suddenly dream about our mother or about our father or about a friend that has passed on, and we see him very clearly, we can identify him very clearly. But not only in dreams, this is not in dreamy sleep, but memory can do that too. In our daydreams, this is now the daydreams, we can recall that for which the poet Tennyson expressed the heart's desire, namely the touch of a vanished hand and the sound of a voice that is still. We say, I still can hear so-and-so saying so-and-so. We say that. And we still can hear that voice that is still. We can still feel the hand, the touch of a hand, a handshake that has made a great impression, though that hand has vanished. We can reproduce, so to say, to memory, everything. The mind, small m, may even be cognizant of a present flavor and odor when no viand touches the palate and no sense salutes the nostrils. That's what I said before. Very often we just can smell something without that the smell is here, because that smell has made a terrific impression on us at one time long ago, but we can reproduce the smell and the taste of something. So she appeals actually to all the five physical senses and says, you can hear thought, you can see thought, you can touch thought or feel thought, you can smell it, and you can, what is the other one? Taste it. Huh? Yeah. Those five physical senses are what? They are nothing else but mortal mind. We know that then, Mrs. Eddy, in the general exposition of Christian Science in the textbook, she will show that the material senses are nothing else but mortal mind that believes that it dwells in matter. The moment mortal mind is believed to dwell in matter, when that spiritualistic sense is entertained, then that produces the testimony of the five physical senses. That's where all the five physical senses take their authority. From mortal mind in matter, that makes up the five physical senses. That's why always mind, spirit, soul is so important in our Christian Science reasoning, because they form the fundamental nature of being, whereas life, truth, and love are then the demonstration of that fundamental nature, and so they are the essence of the principle. And so in this way we have dealt with that question that is always puzzling people, why it is possible to recall everything that has passed on before, or to recall things that are far away. And she just brings it right back to one common denominator and says, well, these are impressions of thought, and that these thoughts are still in the general atmosphere of mortal mind. This leads us to the last subject, and again, in this last subject of love, here she compares Christian Science again with spiritualism. Again, here she takes up one phenomenon and says this very phenomenon can be either the outcome of Christian Science or it can be the outcome of spiritualism. You just have to go right back and ask for the cause. We have the epitome here. Now I read the right one. In Christian Science, only divine mind and its ideas can produce so-called wonders. The so-called wonders of spiritualism are only illusions and delusions. Now we come to the wonders, to the miracles that we research and say, what are these so-called wonders? Are they really mysterious and of a higher source? Are they divine? Have they a divine source? Or have they just a spiritualistic source? And therefore, here she, so to say, presents the common denominator of that whole second part by saying, now, how are veritable ideas to be distinguished from illusions? That great question which every student has and brings up time and time again, because it's an important question, how can I know if a situation or if anything is actually an idea and not an illusion? How can I know that it is something that is real and not elusive? This is important to know so that we don't take illusions for ideas or that we take ideas for illusions. How can we be sure that something is really an idea and not just an illusion? The answer is by learning the origin of each. You see, I gave that answer right at the beginning of the second part to help the reasoning in this part, but actually it's only now at the end that she boils it down to the core of it and says, look here, the whole thing is a question of looking for the cause and not for the effect. The effect never teaches us if it's real or unreal. That's why she has taken all those various effects, like in mind. She took the effect of healing, in spirit she took the effect of force and strength, in the third one the effect of immortality, in the fourth one the effect of mind reading or interpretation, what is a right interpretation, and every time she would show we have to see from where it comes. Now here she gives the final answer and says, look here, ideas are emanations from the divine mind. If we can trace back an effect to the divine mind, then it is an idea. If we cannot trace it back, then it is illusion. So thoughts proceeding from the brain or from matter are therefore only offshoots of mortal mind. They are not divine thoughts. So if a thought comes to us, and if it is a nice thought that comes to us, we usually say this is an inspiration. We never really analyze if it is an inspiration or if it's just the unconscious mind that is coming up to the conscious level and is just as mortal mind as anything else. So we cannot say that if a new thought comes to us, if we see something new, that is from God. Just because it's new, although the subconscious, the collective subconscious, the archetypal subconscious, the collective subconscious can come up to consciousness, and because it comes up, it's new to us, and then we say it is from God because we didn't know it. And here she said, be careful, that can be just as mortal as what you know consciously. They are mortal material beliefs. Therefore, again, ideas on the other side are spiritual, harmonious, and eternal. They are not really mortal. Whereas beliefs proceed from the so-called material senses, which at one time are supposed to be substance matter, and at another are called spirits. It is interesting to see here the, so to say, the order of how spiritualism builds itself up. We have seen before, spiritualism starts with mortal mind. The second point is that mortal mind says, I objectify myself and therefore I matter, giving the second one. Then spiritualism goes further and says, if I put mortal mind into matter, I have sensation, the counterfeit of soul. And then these sensations, these so-called material senses, form beliefs. It says beliefs proceed from the so-called material senses. The beliefs, the physical senses, the material senses, they then formulate, so to say, a theory, a hypothesis. They formulate a so-called principle and believe in that. And they make that own beliefs. And so, which are at one time are supposed to be substance matter, say, this is true, this is a fact, and another time are called spirits. Now, here she goes on and shows now something. It says, to love one's neighbor as one's self is a divine idea. This has nothing to do with the structure of the subject, but still it is very interesting that she doesn't say what the Bible says, that to love one's neighbor as oneself, she says as one's self, and not as oneself, as one's own self. This is much more impressive because it says that the other is actually one's own self, that is a divine idea, because man is an idea, and so we can't say that idea man is me and that idea man is the other. It's both the same. So she elaborated, so to say, on the biblical rendering and put it on a scientific basis and says, look here, this is really loving your neighbor when the other neighbor is your own self, and you don't love him as you love yourself, but you love him as your own self, namely as man. That is much more scientific, and that is a divine idea. The other one would just be a nice Christian emotion to say, well, love your brother as you love yourself. Don't do to your brother what you wouldn't like to do to yourself. This is just nice Christian metaphysics, but here she has to do with idea and says, actually, you should see that man is idea, and that man as idea is neither yourself and the other self, but it's just the one and only self. But that's a side note. What the subject here wants to bring out is something else. Namely, but this idea can never be seen, felt, nor understood through the physical senses. She repeats that again and says, look here, ideas cannot be brought back to consciousness through the physical senses. This is a realm all by itself. But she says, and this is the point, excite the organ of veneration or religious faith, and the individual manifests profound adoration. But you can also do the very opposite, namely, excite the opposite development, and he blasphemes. So, you see, profound adoration and to blaspheme has, so to say, a common origin. It all depends what you do with your organs. If you excite the organ of veneration, of religious faith, if with your mortal mind you just excite that veneration, then the the outcome is profound adoration, but you can also excite the other way around. And you say, excite the opposite development, and he blasphemes. So you can see that profound adoration and blaspheming is an outcome that is not the fact in being, it's just the outcome of a manipulation of mortal mind. So these effects, however, do not proceed from Christianity. So both do not proceed from Christianity. We would say that profound adoration is a office or is an aspect of true Christianity. Christians, they have great profound adoration. And she says, that is not necessarily so, that profound adoration comes from a high source, like Christianity. It can also come just by exciting the organ of veneration, just by exciting mortal mind. So we can build up with mortal mind the very same phenomenon as with true Christianity, namely adoration, the very same. So the outward appearance does not tell us anything about the inner value of something. And that is, you see, why so often we have that situation that students come around and say, I have heard this and that in a religious group, or I have read this and that in a wonderful book. They say the same thing as Christian Science. And when, because they talk about the same effects as Christian Science. But then you have to wonder, now, what is their cause? Is that cause then really spiritual, or is it mortal thought? So these fakirs, they can walk over hot coal, we can't. So they must be more divine than we. That's a false reasoning. Huh? They can do a phenomena that is higher than what we can, therefore they must have a higher consciousness. That's the wrong reasoning. Instead of saying, let's go back to the cause, why the fakir can walk over hot coal and we can't, and we come to the conclusion that he has trained his mortal mind to that point where he does not believe that hot coal can burn. And it has nothing to do either with Christianity or with God. It has to do with mortal mind. So actually, he believes more in mortal mind than we, and because he believes more in mortal mind in a certain way, he can walk over hot coal or over and lie on a bed of nails. We can't, very uncomfortable for us, but that doesn't make them more divine. On the contrary, it makes them more mortal.